listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from the Latin America Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. We spoke with Tony live from Managua via Skype on Monday. This coming week is a lot to cover, of course, but last week we saw the summit of the BRICS countries, and among the BRICS countries, of course, is Brazil, being the brick in that wall from Latin America, Caribbean region, South America to be specific.
Yeah, and the BRICS summit is always very important because precisely for Latin America, certainly precisely because of Brazil's role as one of the founding countries of the BRICS. But in the current context, and the interesting thing for you and me in particular, given the conversations that we've had about the Latin America's position in the global context for many months, we've been discussing this, is that the right-wing government of the usurper president Michel Temer continues to give extremely high priority to these BRICS summits.
Right.
And that is an indication of the extent to which the Latin American right-wing oligarchic elites recognize that the United States is in decline. The United States is essentially a financialized economy and has very little to offer by way of productive investment that's going to increase the wealth of the societies of the countries in Latin America. And that fundamental recognition is forcing, as it were, the Latin American elites to cut some kind of deal and engage in some way, whether enthusiastically or not, with the structures that are being developed by the Russian Federation and China in particular. But as you and I saw just earlier when we were talking about the whole BRICS system before we started this conversation, and the reality is that Russia and China are doing bending over backwards to treat their other BRICS partners as full equals and taking into consideration all their concerns.
Yeah.
And that's reflected in the fact, for example, that in the BRICS documents that you and I had a chance to review quickly before we started talking, there's no mention, for example, of the thorny relationship of China with Pakistan.
Right.
Right?
That's right.
One of the interesting things about all this is that there's a sense of a boring level of mundane humdrum activity that is going to go on below the headlines.
Right, a normality, like it almost is becoming routine now. There are these processes that are in motion that are, you know, that spring from this new multipolarity that almost feel boring because, hey, this multipolarity thing is just like ongoing, like processes, like when people go to work. It's just becoming normalized. And, you know, on that point, before we get any deeper, I see where you're going, but so this one this year was BRICS in Africa. It was held in Johannesburg. Collaboration right. for Inclusive Growth and Shared Prosperity in the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And they discuss in particular engaging with South Africa and other African nations to help develop infrastructure there. And next year, it's going to be Brazil. And you can bet, again, that this is going to be the emphasis. We'll be looking at the region, Latin America and the Caribbean, as one ripe for, you know, further infrastructure development. And so it's interesting that they're focusing on this, and you know, this is signed by all five parties: Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Even though you've had these contradictions at the head of state level, whether in Brazil with the coup that you mentioned, in essence of Temer, the usurper president, in India, as Modi goes, you know, blows with the wind one way or the other in terms of the geopolitical contest between the hegemony model and the multipolarity model, or more specifically, the U.S. and EU on one side and the rest of the world on the other. It seems like this kind of multipolar organization is so regularized that even as they attempt, the U.S. and others attempt to put the genie back in the bottle and sacrifice all this on the altar of hegemony, they have to use the multipolar institutions to do it because they're so, you know, so firmly developed at this point. Not maximum, but enough where you can't just go and it's gone.
Yeah, and I think that, and going back to what you said about this particular BRICS summit being focused on Africa, and there's so much similarity between the geopolitical trends as they affect Latin America and the geopolitical trends as they affect Africa. What's going on in Africa? China is investing in enormous infrastructure projects as part of its Belt and Road Initiative, the New Silk Road Initiative, mm-hmm. That they hope will integrate important parts of Africa's economy into the Eurasian economy that they're trying to develop.
The string
There's
of
so
pearls
many bits
also.
And pieces that's, to this, Don.
That's like the string of pearls is also part of that. That the part that stretches to Africa is the part.
Yeah, and just really boring things like electricity generation.
Right.
Integration. I mean that's currently going on, and there was an article on the web recently by a guy looking at electricity generation integration in Central Asia between the former Central Asian Soviet republics, and like Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, all those countries, and all that is going on underneath the headlines that the mainstream corporate media can deliberately hide from people, as it were, and I think they do it deliberately, because what it means is that the world is moving. It's just moving on ahead. I mean, the Eurasian Economic Union is going to engage with the BRICS countries. It's going to engage with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, of which some of them are member countries. And they're going to engage with the China Belt and Road, Silk Road Initiative. And all that is going to integrate into Africa. Right. And so, but what does the United States have to offer Africa? Well, it's AFRICOM, and that's about it.
That's right.
You know, or extractive corporate activities.
Well, they go hand in hand. I mean, you know, AFRICOM basically is the gun that they point in the face of the people there when they say, okay, go dig up all your stuff over there and carry it to my boat over here.
Right, yeah, and so that's the United States approach, and they use the direct military approach, and the European Union mixed that military approach, principally via France's interventions in Mali, in Central Africa, and elsewhere, with the economic approach, whereby France, in particular, has reactivated its deep colonial control of in particular of West Africa in the service of to the European Union, in the sense that it gives a strong access to resources and financial control of what's the population of West Africa, something like 200 and something million, I'm more than that, but and they are completely controlled financially by the Central Bank of France,
right.
And so all that, you have to juxtapose all that against what China is offering. While the European Union and the United States are sucking all they can of the lifeblood of Africa to sustain their own rotten economies and their own rotten corporate-based societies, China is offering Africa infrastructure development and social and economic development. That will give autonomy and self-sustainability to Africa's economies.
Right.
Now, if you transfer that to Latin America, you see exactly the same kinds of patterns.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so what does the United States have to offer Latin America? Well, subjugation to the United
right.
States' failed financialized economy that
right.
depends on this massive kind of shell game of trying to sustain their economy without real productive investment. That's the key thing. The fundamental thing is investment. Now, the United States doesn't invest anything in the development of the productive capacity of Latin America to speak
right.
of.
That's right.
And it's all financialized extraction.
That's right.
And as one can see in Argentina, for example, where they have this current crisis where the government of Mauricio Macri is now hopelessly in hock to the International Monetary Fund that has essentially taken over
yep.
control of Argentina's domestic economy.
It's
and
amazing
its policy.
How little time it took to undo the work that was done in like 15 years by Nestor Kirchner and Cristina Kirchner. It took Macri, when did he get elected? In December of
2015? November 2015.
Okay. So it's not even 3 years yet that he's been in office, and he was able to undo like 15 years worth of work straightening out accounts with exactly all of those vultures. And I don't just mean the vulture funds that the vultures on Wall Street call vultures, which, however, is expert testimony on the matter. But the actual vultures that the actual vultures on Wall Street have, and your all of the institutions that you know carry this to the four corners of the earth, the IMF, the World Bank, etc.
Right, sure.
You know, you have all of that. Let me give a quick outline from this document because it's useful to take a look at that also. You have a willingness to engage here by the BRICS countries that is. You know, really further developed from even last year. The second item on their outline is to strengthen multilateralism. They're talking globally. In other words, let's keep developing this model going forward. And Brazil is signing this. I want to emphasize that again. For example,
right.
reforming global governance and addressing common challenges. Okay, they also go to strengthening and consolidating BRICS cooperation in international peace and security. They want to have a footprint you know, in the midst of the international order, then BRICS partnership under item 4 for global economic recovery, reform of financial and economic global governance institutions, and the fourth industrial revolution. I mean, these are big goals for this thing that's taking, and then people-to-people cooperation, and, you know, they go into the things people are more used to after that.
Yeah, and if you look at events in Latin America where the United States has used its corrupt local partners to attack the sovereignty, the national sovereignty of governments in Latin America, that's the essential thing. The United States has to destroy national sovereignty in Latin America and the Caribbean, because that is the only protection the peoples of the region have against corporate predators. So,
right.
So the going back to Argentina now, and compare that to what happened in Chile with the coup in 1973, and what was the coup? What was, if you look beyond the horror of the coup,
right,
and the human cost of the coup, what did that mean in geopolitical terms for the United States? It meant that the United States was able to impose its neoliberal model that later came to be called the Washington Consensus, and it defended that by a vicious abuse of human rights and the destruction of civil society in Chile.
I mean, these are the things that are being offered now for economic and domestic policy neoliberalism, and for international policy, and for, you know, both foreign policy from the local up and from the grand down. Neocon policy. So
I want to stick with Argentina because
But that's what I'm saying.
What you see in Argentina now is the Macri government is saying that Macri has just, by presidential decree, changed Argentina's constitution to allow the army to have responsibility in some areas of domestic public order. Okay, so I'm. What is that? That is a kind of a slightly paler reflection of what Pinochet did in Chile.
Right. It's necessary, though, because when they start carrying people's goods out of their houses and shipping them off to New York or Miami or wherever, some of those people get very unhappy. And they express their displeasure. They try first through the political institutions, and when they fail, they take up arms or they sit on their hands in the streets or they resist. And so if you're going to survive that as a group imposing this on people, well, you got to have the army at the ready, basically. And so they're getting ready.
In the current context in Argentina, Macri's moving is extremely controversial because, like today, the teachers' unions in Argentina have started a 48-hour strike. That's the context in which Macri has said, well, let's get the army to control public order in some cases.
Right?
So, and what's going to happen over the next few months? Are we now going to see the Argentinian armed forces repressing Argentinian teachers and nurses and doctors? Is that what we're going to see? We don't know, but that's the obvious fear. That's not a theoretical fear. It's not hypothetical, because just across the border from Argentina in Brazil, you have large areas of, for example, Sao Paulo and other important urban centers that have been completely militarized. But that doesn't get reported in The Guardian, the BBC, the New York Times, or National Public Radio, or Democracy Now, right?
Right.
That it doesn't exist as far as all those phony media are concerned.
That's right.
And so... But it's a very real concern for people in Argentina when Macri brings in this measure that is being challenged in the legislature, by the way, in a context in which just across the border in Brazil, in very important urban centers have been militarized with deaths and everything that's associated with the militarization of public spaces.
Right. Well, I mean, look, there's the whole history in Argentina of military involvement in domestic politics and people being disappeared and executed and, you know, juntas and all of that stuff. And there were reforms that were intended to fix this, including a decree in 2006 that limited the armed forces to defense against external attack. And,
correct.
And that is now what is being, what you know, Mauricio Macri has attempted to, or claims to have, removed. And then, as you said, that is being fought domestically.
Yeah. So then, and that, all that's happening in a context in which, for example, the US allies are engaged in a kind of somewhat paradoxical relationship in terms of developing their neoliberal-based model, with a corporate-led model that they claim will lead to prosperity for everybody. Ha ha. Right. You know, and it's just... And so but that's the propaganda. The propaganda is from countries like Chile, Peru, Colombia, and the current government of Mexico, led by outgoing President Peña Nieto, is that their Pacific Alliance neoliberal corporate trade-led policies will somehow magically bring prosperity to their country's impoverished majority.
Right.
And so they're engaged with China, they're engaged with the countries of what's the kind of reborn Trans-Pacific Partnership without the United States, which the United States under President Trump may well end up in the most humiliating way possible trying to rejoin. But these Pacific Alliance countries took a very important step in regional terms last week when they held a summit with the countries of Mercosur.
Yep.
Mercosur is the kind of has been a moribund trade bloc, originally formed by Brazil, Argentina, and their two tiny neighbors, Paraguay and Uruguay, tiny comparatively.
Right.
And those four countries attempted an expansion in the first decade of this current century, and tried to incorporate Venezuela, tried to incorporate Bolivia.
Right.
But now the right-wing governments in Brazil, Argentina, and Paraguay have decisively excluded Venezuela, even though Venezuela legally can't be excluded from Mercosur. They just took the arbitrary ad hoc decision to exclude Venezuela.
Yep, they're suspended is the term of art they use.
Yeah. They suspended Venezuela. And they're refusing to ratify the incorporation of Bolivia.
Mm-mm.
And that's on the level of the battle for regional integration, that's quite a serious setback for progressive countries like Bolivia and Venezuela. It's not the end of the world because things change.
Right.
And maybe I don't know if we'll have time to talk about the Brazilian election before we finish. But the important thing is that these leaders, Brazil, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Argentina, met with the leaders of the Pacific Alliance countries, Mexico, Colombia, Peru, and Chile, and they kind of made an agreement to kind of advance their version of Latin American and Caribbean integration.
Right.
But the interesting thing about that is, well, what's going to be the role of Mexico once Andrés Manuel López Obrador assumes the presidency later this year? Will he be as favorable to the kind of integration, corporate-led integration, that the Pacific Alliance have been pushing to date? It's unlikely that he's going to make any radical change in Mexico's position on that, but there will be a change in some sense in the way that López Obrador and his diplomatic team try and project their interest in developing the Pacific Alliance. It's likely to be less favorable. Mexico's policy is likely to be less favorable towards global corporate interests than that of the government of Peña Nieto.
I mean, that's going to be the test,
How seriously will that affect the overall policies of the Pacific Alliance and this process towards neoliberal neoliberal model of integration? Who knows?
Right.
But the interesting thing about it, Don, is that as we've been saying for months, and the United States does not have a decisive role in that anymore.
That's right.
Because it's so focused on Latin America's relationship with Asia, and in particular China.
Yeah, there are objective reasons for the United States not to have such a large role anymore. They spring out of the long history. Some of it rests just on popular sentiment on the ground as a consequence of that history. And other, a major portion of it has to do with just the objective conditions, globally. This model of multipolarity isn't just some exercise taking place in a classroom. It translates into, thousands, even millions of business transactions on a daily basis. All kinds of human activity on the ground that, is oriented and or directed in different ways than it was during the period of hegemony. And so the United States can't step in, for example, and, say on television to the leaders of, say, five South American countries, okay, this is what you're going to do when you get up tomorrow morning. If we let you have your coffee, it's after your coffee. They can't do that anymore. Instead, they have all kinds. First of all, China's there saying, well, we have some green tea and we have some excellent coffee. And by the way, we were thinking of just going out and laying in the sun in the afternoon. Why don't you come with us? We have some business to discuss. There's a whole different objective condition that exists where the guy with the gun telling you to give him your stuff isn't the only guy in town anymore.
And we're going to see that, aren't we, with the development of the United States was able to block Nicaragua's attempt to work with China to build an interoceanic canal, at least for the moment.
Yep.
But they're not going to be able to block the transoceanic railway that's going to run from Peru through Bolivia and Brazil and Paraguay.
Right.
Even the Pacific Alliance and Mercosur countries want to see happen.
That's right. That there are stops all along that rail from the Pacific to the Atlantic that will become areas of development, hubs of development for the interior of this huge continent called South America. And everybody involved wants to make money on it, believe me.
Yeah, and what has been the U.S. contribution in that context? Their contribution has been to set up more military bases in the region.
Yeah, that we're not building a railroad. We want your stuff, put it on the back of a mule, and send it out to the coast where our boat's waiting. They don't build railroads to help loot, to help you help them loot you. They don't even do that.
That is very telling, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, the contrast is really damning.
Yep.
I mean, the United States is good at kind of setting up military bases and intimidating governments via Wall Street.
That's right.
But it's absolutely hopeless at any kind of productive investment that's going to transform Latin American productive capacity.
Right, that's right. By its nature, I mean, if there were steel available for a railroad, they would sell the steel at a discount to somebody and just cash it out. It's a financialized economy. It does not have a stake in developing infrastructure anymore, according to its own rules.
Right. So then, regionally, and I don't know if you've got time to look at stuff in Ecuador and Colombia, for example, but
yeah, we have about 3 minutes left.
Okay, so and it's worth bearing in mind that in the context that we've just been talking about, the kind of turncoat government of President Lenin Moreno in Ecuador is looking at joining the Pacific Alliance, and a symbol of that is the way that it's decided to try and sell off the headquarters in the Ecuadorian capital, Quito, of the Union of South American Nations. And there's a huge social protest against that currently going on in Ecuador.
Yep. I guess they also plan to rent out the space that Julian Assange has been occupying in the London, where the ambassador is in London, the London mission, because apparently his departure, Assange's departure from the embassy in London is imminent, according to the reports we heard over the weekend.
Yeah, and that's just another example of the way Ecuador, under Lenin Moreno, whose popularity has slumped way below 50% now,
yep,
after initially being quite popular until people realize what he really was,
right,
really is.
Right.
And he says that he's been negotiating Assange's departure with the British government for some time.
Yep. Yeah, we're finding out an awful lot about Lenny. Lenny's, I don't know that Lenny's going to end up serving out his whole term, because he ran on exactly on a platform that is exactly the opposite of what he's implementing. He ran against, as a matter of fact, the platform that he's implementing, and he did so, you know, rather eloquently and very effectively. He won, you know, handily. Because A, of what he was saying, and B, because of the enormous popularity of President Correa, who endorsed him. And now he's doing exactly what he, you know, criticized so effectively on the one hand as policy, and he's also at the same time been attacking former President Correa almost from out of the gate when he took office.
Yeah, and that it seems to me that that's just another example of the way that, and if, although people may be fooled for a while by these individuals like Moreno, like Macri, and like Temer and the others, and they very quickly realize what the reality is because they have to live that material economic reality.
That's exactly right. These people are looting you for a reason. Why? Because at the end of the day, they want your stuff. When you wake up and your stuff is gone, the first thing you say is, hey, where'd my stuff go? And then when you answer the question, you say, oh, that guy, okay, and then you settle accounts.
Right.
All right, we've got a minute left. What's happening in Nicaragua? Is it normalizing?
Well, and here, it's the same story here. And people were fooled for maybe a week, 2 weeks, max 3 weeks by the right-wing claims of government repression, which were completely false. Mm. And the calls for the government to resign, people were fooled by that for maybe 2 or 3 weeks. And now they realize that it was all a big lie.
Yep. And so they're actually going for that same game in Moscow right now, apparently. You know, there's a just the central theme being a change in pensions. There's a substantial proposal that's been proposed in Russia and to up the retirement age 5 years almost for men. And there was a response from that, which made the media, and it made it look like the people are going in the streets in Moscow and around Russia. And I thought to myself, gee, didn't we just go through this in Nicaragua? Where are the students? So, but we'll talk about that next week. And also, we have a little more to go to cover, particularly talk about Uribe and some of the other things that are happening in the region. Tony, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure, as always.
Okay, you're very welcome. Thanks to you, Don.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. Politics as we know it was born in cities. No wonder cities, especially big ones, may feel entitled to calling the shots for other, more impoverished and disadvantaged communities. But in 2016, small towns and the countryside struck back, first with the Brexit and then with the election of Donald Trump. Was there something that the big city dwellers, the cosmopolitan elite, failed to grasp about the rest of their countries? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Richard Florida, professor at the University of Toronto and a best-selling author. Professor Florida, thank you very much for your time. It's good to talk to you. Now, your book was the first book, The Rise of the Creative Class, was published more than 15 years ago, but it still causes a lot of heated debates, especially here in Russia. And I heard some people describe it as a neoliberal manual for spreading homosexuality under the guise of urbanism. I'm sure it's not the case, but I wonder how country-specific your work is and how applicable the trends that you have highlighted to other societies.
Well, first of all, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you. It's fantastic to be in this magnificent city, in this unbelievable setting. And I'm glad people in Russia are talking about me, because it'd be worse if they weren't. So on the one hand, you have people who say it's a neoliberal manual for a gay agenda, from the right, if you will. And from the left, they say it's a neoliberal manual for gentrification and the colonization of cities by the elite. On the one hand, they say Florida, the creative class didn't exist, and it couldn't exist, and there's no such thing. And on the other hand, they say the creative class gentrified our cities. Look, I'm simply trying the best I can with my eyes and my ears and my research teams to actually look at what's happening in cities. But one thing we know is that cities that were open to the gay and lesbian population, cities that had a large artistic design, music, literary, bohemian population, those cities tended to be the cities where entrepreneurs, technological innovators, settled and had higher rates of innovation. So that's what we reported.
Absolutely, but this is not just your ideas. You based it on a certain statistical data. And I wonder, again, if that data is more specific to the United States than, let's say, you know, the Middle East or Eastern Europe.
You know, for sure, our data was born in the United States. But there were a guy, I forget his name, at the Institute for International Economics in Washington who kind of wanted to try to understand the Middle East. And he ran an analysis of the whole world. Now, not at the city level, but at the national level. And in this analysis, he said, I want to look at the role of openness to gay and lesbian people in relation to two things. How globalized that economy was, and how productive and how well it performed economically. And he was shocked. He was literally shocked to find that the openness to the gay and lesbian population had a lot to say about how globally oriented that economy was and how economically productive
it
was.
Well, I suppose there would be another correlation to how well are that country's relations with the United States, because the United States tends to export its country's, its values rather, on its allies. So that would be a correlant too.
Yeah, I just don't know. But I think, look, I have no gay agenda. It's really interesting. You know, I grew up in a working class blue collar family in a very racist and homophobic environment. So for me, the discovery of these things was not about any kind of agenda, but simply trying to look at the market and non-market factors that are associated. And the point of view is it wasn't the gay and lesbian population, nor was it a bohemian artistic population. Places that are open to men and women, boys and girls, people of ethnic and racial differences tend to benefit because different kinds of people combining and recombining lead to better and stronger economies.
But what I'm particularly interested in is what you define as openness, because many societies in the Middle East, as well as here in Russia, have different ways of expressing that openness. For example, Lebanon, Beirut is a gay capital of the Middle East at night, but it is a fairly conservative Muslim society during the day. I wonder if what you define as openness is very culturally specific.
I can only tell you what my data tell me. Look, I'm a repressed or recovering Catholic, taught by the Sisters of Our Lady of St. Joseph, went to Our Lady Queen of Peace, taught by the Christian Brothers. By the way, my wife's Arabic. She's Christian Arabic, but her family's from Jordan. I've taught in Abu Dhabi. So I know kind of the world pretty well. And what my data tell me is that places that are open to difference, places that open new ideas, are more innovative. Can we push every society at the same pace? No. Every society has its own rules, its own norms. But the point is that the places that tend to be the most open-minded end up with a kind of innovation like San Francisco or the Bay Area. The places that aren't, what happens, which is quite tragic, then if you're gay or you're a lesbian or you're a woman and you feel oppressed or a member of an ethnic or racial minority, if you have ability, you leave and you migrate to one of those places. So, look, I'm the last one trying to impose my norms on anyone. I'm just saying that these things, from an empirical point of view, seem to matter.
I think we are living in a very interesting time when part of our cultures, culture and values are globalized, especially in big cities, but some part of it is very, very local. And there we are seeing tensions between those sets of values in your own country and around the world. You travel the globe a lot. Have you seen a place, a country, where those sets of values integrate harmoniously, when you can tolerate difference without necessarily becoming somebody else, retaining the core part of your national identity?
No. Canada's the closest. Canada, where I live, part of the year, is the closest, but we even see the backlash there. We invented populism with this crazy Mayor Ford, and now his brother is the premier of the largest province, Ontario. But here's what I think. We are going through a dramatic economic and social and cultural transformation. Parts of our society are winning, and parts of these cosmopolitan urban centers have new values. Women want to participate. Gay and lesbian people want. Immigrants want rights. And many cities are saying, that's my way. But there are more traditional parts of society that are saying, no, I don't want that. I live in a more of a rural community. In the United States, a signal issue is gun ownership. Here's where I get in trouble as a person of the left. Here's where I get in trouble with my colleagues on the left. I believe we shouldn't have one national policy. I believe in a country that's divided, probably as much as any in the world, we actually have to localize our government. We have to say, we can't get in each other's face. If I want to live in a cosmopolitan city with incredible women's rights and gay rights and no guns and whatever, I should be able to live there. If you want to live in a city that has a different approach and that's what you like, you should be able to live there. Startling fact for your viewers. In the United States, less than 20% of Americans have trust and faith and confidence in the federal government. We're divided 50-50 on our states. About 75 to 85% of us have trust and faith and confidence in our local government. That's because we get to pick where we live and elect the leaders we want. I actually think this, we used to call it mutual deterrence or mutual coexistence with the U.S. and Russia. I think mutual coexistence is the way, and localized governance, that I can live in my area, you live in your area, we share some basic underlying principles, but I'm not going to get in your face is the way we
well,
have to
go. Well, you say you're a person of the left, but do you think that kind of philosophy is acceptable to many of the leftists in the United States?
No.
Because they seem to be very set on seeing the kind of world they want to see, and without recognizing that others may see it differently.
You know, the United States is divided in a way I would have never anticipated. And it's become, in the words of my colleague Jonathan Haidt at NYU, a tribal fight. The new religion in the United States is really, I have my left way, you have your right way. No, and my friends on the left get mad at me, but I don't see any other way out. And not just for the United States. I see this as a global phenomenon. There are, in this kind of wrenching economic time, where you're transitioning sexual norms, cultural norms, economic conditions, there are a lot of people who are saying, no, it's too fast for me. I just think there's got to be a way to allow people to live differently. And the only way I can see that happening is by localizing governance, by taking the power out of the national levels and giving it to the local levels. I think we need a society that can be more of a federation of localities than is a one way, my way or the highway.
Now, I mentioned before that there are many people in Russia who know your work and argue about it. It actually even produced a special word in the Russian language. It's pronounced as kriakal, which is a pejorative for trendy-looking men and women who put their comfort above their country. And I think that captures the fear on the part of certain traditionalists in this country that cosmopolitanism and patriotism are incompatible. I wonder if you actually agree with them on some level.
I think I put my finger on something unwittingly. You know, living in Pittsburgh, in a very kind of back place, not in New York or London, writing about the creative class, I think I put my finger on something that I didn't fully understand. So, you know, I didn't propagate this debate in Russia or Sweden or the United Kingdom and have this heated argument. Look, I think what you're saying is the conflict of our time. And because we're so geographically, not only class divided, we're geographically divided. The urban cosmopolitans in one place, the traditionalists in another place, that's what's causing this. So I think this divide, I line up personally more on the cosmopolitan side, but I come from a place that is much more on the traditional side. I travel the world. I go to the American South. I talk to people. And people are good. People are good. They want what's best for their community. So I guess what I'm saying is I can't impose my values on them. They can't impose their values on me. We have to learn to coexist.
And yet people who think like you, they do have the command of the media. They usually have the stage. And they do assume that their values are more or less universal or ought to be universal.
Well, they should wake up because Donald Trump really is the president of the United States. And if I look at the national level in my country, it's not been this general liberal awakening in terms of national level politics. I mean, I was born when Eisenhower was president and Kennedy. But, you know, it's gone Reagan and then Bush and then a little blip with Clinton and then George W. Bush and then Obama and now Trump. Our country may be, in a way, trending more right. And so this idea that everyone can live in the world I would like, liberal, cosmopolitan, utopia, that's not happening. So I think what we can do is tolerate difference. Now, my friends on the left will say, oh, my God, now he's a neoliberal shill for conservatism, not gay rights. They'll twist it the opposite way. But I don't see a way out. When we get to this kind of economic and social and cultural divide, we can't keep imposing my cosmopolitan creative way, your traditional working way. It just won't work. And by the way, you know, I have a guy who used to be a big opponent of mine, Joel Kotkin. And he's written about the suburban traditional communities. I've written about the urban cosmopolitan communities. When Trump was elected, I sent him a note and said, Joel, we've been arguing past one another. We've become best friends because we simply agree that we will deal with each other's argument and accept each other. And what Joel says to me, who's actually a very cosmopolitan guy in his own outlook, he says, Richard, people in suburbs are good people. People in rural areas are good people. They don't want what your creative class in the urban areas want. Let's deal with the local. Let's let people choose what they want. But if I want to choose a cosmopolitan way and you want to choose a traditional way, let's find a way to coexist. And that's what makes a great nation or great collection of people.
Well, Professor Florida, we have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Richard Florida, professor at the University of Toronto and the best-selling author. Professor Florida, just before the break, we were talking about this conflict between the environment, the urban environment, and the land. At least that's how I conceptualize it, that some people enjoy the environment and the feel of the city, and some people have a deeper connection to their land. And I think what we have seen in both Brexit and the election of Donald Trump is the commitment on the part of certain electorate to, you know, develop that land, the land that has been ignored, or they feel has been ignored because the other cities usurped all the resources. As an economist, do you think there's any truth to that, or is it just venting the anger?
No, I actually think too much has been made of economic inequality in both Brexit and the election of Trump. And actually, it wasn't the least advantaged people. I'm not saying they were the most advantaged, but the people who voted for Brexit or Trump tended to have some level of economic advantage. They weren't the poorest. What really is behind it is geographic inequality. The people who voted for Mrs. Clinton tended to live in the largest, the most diverse, the most innovative metropolitan areas. I forget the number, but it's not a lot. The people who voted for Donald Trump, similarly with Brexit, came from smaller metropolitan areas, suburban areas, and rural areas. So I think it is where people live, and it reflects this shift in both economic opportunity and in values. And look, it's leading to the seesawing in politics. You know, one time you get a more liberal, one time you get a more conservative, one time you get an open England, the next time you get a Brexit.
Now, I know that you were traumatized by both Brexit and certainly the election of Donald Trump, but what you're saying here is essentially that we live in a day and age when it is easier for people to change a country or to change a location where they live rather than change things within that location. And it is easier to vote with your feet, to move out of the neighborhood that you don't like. Don't you think that Mr. Trump, as much as you detest him, represents, you know, a different kind of philosophy of, you know, let's stay here and let's do something about those rundown communities?
I wish, but I think everything in his public policy perspective is hurting those communities, whether it's high tariffs, whether it's elimination of the safety net, whether it's really deregulating labor laws. So I think what's really interesting is he still gets votes from those places, even after he's acting against their interests. What I find really fascinating when we think about all of this, you know, I read the social media, I'm on Twitter, I'm sitting here in Moscow with you. What do I hear? Trump and Putin and this and that, and the U.S. and Russia and this and that. When I come to Moscow, and it's an amazing city. And at this conference, no one's talking about that. They're talking about how do you build a great city? What are best practices? How do you build better open space? How do you deal with mobility? How do you deal with inclusion, affordable housing? And in a way, maybe I was traumatized by the election of Trump, but it was my biggest wake-up call to say, just forget about that stuff. I mean, it's just, you can't change it. But what I can do is help to make places like Moscow or New York or Los Angeles or Paris or whatever better, more interesting cities.
In certain ways, you know, if you listen to the mayor of Moscow, you will find many similarities. He, you know, makes many of the same points that Mr. Trump was making during his campaign. You know, invest in the roads and the bridges and the infrastructure that connects cities. Not necessarily, I mean, I've heard you say that he is the sort of most egregious anti-urban president, but do you think you're being fair to him? Because he, in his own very weird way, but he is talking about some of the issues that I'm sure you care about deeply.
I hope the mayor of Moscow is actually doing the investment because Donald Trump isn't.
And well, Moscow's budget for investment is 25%.
So, of its GDP.
I understand
the populist reason for Donald Trump. I think any reasonable reading of the evidence is he's not pursuing a policy agenda which is benefiting those communities. That said, I wish someone would. I think one of the big issues in the United States is how do we move from what I call winner-take-all urbanism, where superstar cities and large metropolitan areas gain and smaller and medium-sized places fall behind. But I don't think the federal government can do that. Maybe I would like it to do it. But I don't think it can. I think that will only come from taking the power from the national level and handing it to the cities to use the way they want. If you're a big city and want to do certain things and invest in transit and be more open-minded, fine. If you're a smaller place and you want to build more roads and bridges and that's the way people get around, fine. But I think we can't do it. It's not one way. There has to be many different ways and a competition. That's what I think. And I would like to see real investment in U.S. infrastructure, between particularly transit and high-speed rail, but our federal government, Trump, and the Congress is not delivering it.
Let me ask you about Rob Ford, whom you mentioned earlier, the former mayor of Toronto, and also, you know, a kind of character that is not the most intuitive social model, a former drug user. In some respects, he predated Trump. What do you think makes people respond to characters like that? Because I've heard you say in some of the other interviews that when Rob Ford was elected, the city economy was generally good. You know, the investment in social infrastructure was increasing. The schools were good. The roads were improving. And yet people opted for that kind of character. What was driving them? I guess it's not all about the economy, stupid, right?
So the Fords, both Rob Ford, who was the mayor of Toronto, and his brother Doug, who's now premier of Ontario. So this is a position like being governor of New York or California or Massachusetts. Their coalition's very different. Trump's coalition was mainly white, predominantly men, but also white women in male-dominated families. Very low votes from immigrants and Hispanic, Latino, black people. The Fords, in contrast, not only took white working-class voters, but took a whole range of what in Canada we call new Canadians. Caribbean, Indian, Chinese. What I think in that case, but I think it's true, is that people were tired of governments that don't deliver. That it was a sense that these governments, city governments, provincial governments, national governments, don't deliver, and they want more economic opportunity. One, they don't want to pay as much taxes. And two, they want less government control of their lives and more economic opportunity. That seems to me that's something all of us have to deal with. I may be more on the left. I may believe in a bigger role for government. But a large part of the population is saying something else. We want more economic opportunity. We want lower taxes. We want more effective government. And we don't care if we burn the temple down. That's giving me a wake-up call. And honestly, as hard and wrenching as it's been for me, it's been my biggest growth experience because I realize what we're talking about. My way is one way. There are other ways. And when I talk to my friends and family who voted for Donald Trump or voted for Doug Ford or Rob Ford, I like them. I don't hate them. Yeah, we may have a big argument, but I love them. So they're not bad people. They just think a different way is possible, and I think we have to accommodate that and understand that, well, all of us.
You may be an exception because I actually have friends in the United States who stopped talking to each other, you know, after the election of Donald Trump because one voted for him and another voted for Clinton, and they still don't talk. And I think it's, you know, it's not just my individual experience. I think it's a broader phenomenon when, you know, certain parts of the society don't want to do anything.
So this is telling me something, that we have to, when this happens, when people stop talking to one another, we have to reduce the stakes. There is something wrong with the nationalization of politics, that otherwise sensible people stop talking to one another, reduce the stakes, transfer the power to the local level. When I go to a city, honestly, I can generally not tell if somebody's a Democrat or a Republican, and these fights don't exist. It's only when it comes to Trump or Clinton or this one or that one. So let's reduce the darn stakes. Let's localize. Now, this is going to take a long time. Localize these things, and where things get done pragmatically and less ideologically
but
is locally.
I also wonder whether you think it would be helpful for those urban communities, well-off urban communities, to support more investment into those impoverished communities that elected Donald Trump. Wouldn't that
100%. Be 100%. I think many of us miss the boat when we think somehow a federal government is going to do that. Maybe in some other planet utopia it will. What my friend Ben Barber, the late Ben Barber, who wrote a magnificent book, so sad he died, called If Mayors Ruled the World, was working to was a global parliament of mayors, like a UN, where Ben said these cities could actually work together to do redistribution. So if New York and Moscow and London were prospering, these mayors could get together and create a fund and begin to redistribute money, if they had money coming back from the federal government. So I think we have to think about this in new ways, but this whole idea that's a legacy of the 19th and 20th century, that these strong national governments will somehow fix this problem, it won't happen.
Well, it may not happen for you. I think we in Russia have a different opinion. At least in this country, the government is still, the state is still the main driver of change, including urban change. And, you know, the center where we are sitting right now is, you know, is an example of that, because they still make very large scale investments in big projects while also trying to, you know, encourage investment on the periphery. Do you think that could actually work to, you know, try to reap the benefits of both centralization and decentralization?
Sure. And I think in Europe, generally, there's more of a tradition of having a federal and regional redistribution. So the EU and its attempt to do smart specialization by focusing on declining regions. One of my friends in the United Kingdom said, well, in the United Kingdom, we're small. We could just build high-speed rail. But here's a fact for you. In Russia, Moscow accounts for a third or more of GDP. In Canada, Toronto accounts for 20% of GDP. In the United States, New York is only 10% of GDP. So in many ways, and I'm not trying to make this as a criticism, Russia is a more spatially unequal,
absolutely,
more top-sided, lopsided economy. So even state led redistribution can't solve this. That's telling me something, that maybe the way to deal with this is certainly you could use federal redistribution, but instead of doing that from the top, let the localities keep more money because they are the ones that know how to spend it. So if Moscow needs more bike lanes, I'm making this, you know, I don't know the situation, but if Moscow needs more bike lanes and subway and high-speed rail, spend it there. If an outlying community needs better roads and bridges and better high-speed internet, spend it there. I think this decentralized model could be a way of, one, being more economically effective, and two, overcoming the cultural and social divides that pit us against one another.
Now, in your latest book on the new urban crisis, you approach what's happening in many urban communities as a crisis, but it's only a crisis when you define success in terms of, you know, investment and material gains and so on and so forth. Don't you think that perhaps that's just a natural correction that the system has? Because in your best-selling book, what you described as success was essentially, you know, five big cities essentially getting it all while everybody else was left on the sidelines. Isn't that a natural progression from very skewed system to something more balanced?
So I really think we're going through the greatest economic transformation of human history. From all of human history before us, we got our productivity and our economic growth from physical labor and raw materials. Now the mind has become the means of production. Any kind of economic transformation like this, but especially this one, concentrates talent and ideas and knowledge in a very small handful of places. So really the challenge ahead of us is, how do we make everyone have a meaningful life and meaningful opportunity? That's really the question. There's no way we can go counter to this trend. All we can do is make sure that the disconnected places have more opportunity and are more connected to the fast-growing places. Really, that's the challenge of our time. It's hard to... You can't
but
stop
is that,
this.
Is that really a challenge? Because if you look at the World Value Service, especially in the developed countries, you can see that more and more people value balance between work and family, the ability to make money, to be creative, but also to live your life, to raise your children, and so on and so forth. And I would suppose that this kind of life could be lived not only in big cities, but it pretty much could be lived anywhere. Doesn't that give you
hope? So I wrote a whole book on this called Who's Your City that said, pay attention to this, realize what you want, take location seriously. You spend a lot of time picking an education and career. You spend a lot of time picking a mate and dating and do the same thing with location. Unfortunately, the most ambitious people tend to be moving to these superstar cities. That's still occurring. But yeah, there are lots of fantastic places you can live and spend a lot less on housing and have a lot more work-life balance than running the urban rat race. And you need to make that choice. depending on your family. Certainly, I think it's the most, in my book, I say it's the single most important decision you can make, so make it strategically and make it wisely.
Well, Professor Florida, we have to leave it there. It's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for your time, and encourage our viewers to keep this conversation going in our social media pages, and hope to see you again. Same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.